And good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams, Martha Deal, and Henry Frank is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about malaria and the effort to fight and perhaps one day eradicate the disease. Every year, it's estimated between 300 and 500 million people become sick with malaria. More than a million die of the disease annually, and most of them are young children. It's a major health problem in tropical and subtropical parts of the developing world. There is some positive news. Malaria is both preventable and it is also, in many cases, curable. This morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking about the disease and about the effort to control it with Dr. Awash Teklahaimanot. He's professor of clinical epidemiology at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, where he's also director of the malaria program. He was educated in Ethiopia, where he grew up in Addis Ababa University, and also here at the United States and at Harvard. He also did postdoctoral work at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia. He has extensive international experience in public health with particular focus on Africa and has worked for the World Health Organization in a senior position in Geneva for a number of years. He was also very extensively involved during the last couple of years in the UN Millennium Project, serving as one of the coordinators for Task Force 5. This is dealing with HIV/AIDS, malaria, TB, and access to medicines. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their questions brief so that we can keep our program moving along, but anybody's welcome to call 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments certainly are welcome. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Teklahaimanot, hello.
Yes.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It is a pleasure.
Just to review, perhaps for those people who aren't familiar with malaria, maybe you could just give the basics about what causes malaria and how this disease is transmitted.
It will be a pleasure. Malaria is a parasitic disease. In order for malaria transmission to take place, you will need mosquitoes, vector mosquitoes. Not all mosquitoes transmit the disease, but a special group of mosquitoes are capable of transmitting the disease. And then you have the parasites. There are four types of human parasites, and one of them, Plasmodium falciparum, is the most deadly parasite.
Mm-hmm. So this is a disease that's transmitted by mosquitoes, so we know how it's passed from person to person, and is not a disease that, it's not contagious. That is, one person who has malaria cannot give it to another. You can't get malaria by standing next to a person who has it, not unless you get bitten by a mosquito who's bitten the other person.
Yes, not unless you are bitten by a mosquito or through blood transfusion also.
Mm-hmm. And this is apparently the thinking is that malaria is a very old disease. That is, in the sense that perhaps almost as long as humans have been around in our present form, we have the reason to believe or suspect that malaria has been with us too.
That is true. It is a very, very old disease. It has evolved over a long time, and it has specialized. Even between the four species we have, some of them are not as old as the previous one, the other ones. For example, Plasmodium falciparum, the most deadly one, is not as old as the other ones. And as a result of that, it is not a parasite that is able to treat its host very well. Because what's happening is, if a parasite kills its host, indirectly it is killing itself also.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't, it is that is not survive very well. And therefore, that's why Plasmodium falciparum is most dangerous than the other three other species.
The figures for the numbers of people who contract malaria every year, the numbers that I mentioned at the beginning are the ones that one commonly sees, maybe something between 300 million and 500 million cases every year. I understand also, though, that some people think that that's just an estimate, that in fact nobody really knows, and could it be that the numbers are actually higher than that?
Yeah, right. It is possible, because what's happening is, especially in tropical Africa, an individual might have 3 to 4 episodes in a year. That's why the number seems to be very high. But I think up to 300 to 500 million cases is the most probable number we will have per year in Africa and globally.
And it's certainly striking that the disease is concentrated in certain places, and it's my understanding that close to all, something like 90% of the deaths from malaria are concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa, and most of those are young children.
That's true. That is true, because the environment in Africa is very, very conducive. One is the most efficient vector, mosquito that transmits the disease, is located in Africa. Mm-hmm. Because in different parts of the world, there are different species of mosquitoes that are responsible for malaria transmission. But the one in Africa is a particular one. Anopheles gambiae is the most deadly and most efficient one. So that is one factor. The second factor is the environment. Very warm environment, humid environment, and this is also very conducive to the transmission of malaria. And then another thing is the social conditions, the economic conditions in Africa. The health services are underdeveloped, and therefore people who are sick do not get the service, the treatment in time, and that also adds another risk factor for children dying in time, because if a child do not get service within the first 24 to 36 hours, the chances that the child will make it is very high. And therefore, since the health services coverage in Africa is very, very low, it doesn't go extend into the remote peripheral areas. Children are the victims of malaria.
The disease actually has been eradicated in some places, even some places where the climates are conducive to mosquitoes. It at one time was a greater problem in the United States, and in fact there are still, I believe, some people in the United States still do contract malaria here, not just people who have visited some place where it's endemic and come back and become sick, but people actually who have contracted malaria here. The numbers are relatively small compared with other places in the world, but it still exists in the United States. What made it possible for it to be in the places where it has been eradicated, and what made that possible?
Okay, very good. I think basically malaria is distributed in different parts of the world, in tropics, subtropics, and also in temperate areas. In temperate areas, it is very easy to control the disease, simply because the limitations of temperature on the parasite as well as on the mosquitoes itself. So in countries like in the United States, Northern Europe, it was very easy to control malaria, to eradicate malaria. Simply, the transmission is not as deep-rooted. It is not as stable as you will find it in Africa. That is one factor. And the second important factor is also the socioeconomic development. In North Africa, America, like in the United States, even the last remnants of malaria in the 1950s was eradicated simply because the living standards of the people has improved, housing conditions has improved, health facilities has improved. So this has also a factor to malaria eradication. But, you know, the fact that we have malaria now in Boston, in New York, or in any parts of North America does not mean there is malaria transmission in those areas. What it means is people who travel to malaria areas like to Kenya, to other tourist areas, to Asia, would contact the disease there, and then when they come back, they become sick. Otherwise, there is no malaria transmission in Europe and also in North America.
We have a couple of callers here, and before we go to them, I'd like to introduce again our guest for anyone who might just have tuned in. We're speaking this morning with Dr. Awash Teklehaimanot. He is professor of clinical epidemiology at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, where he is also director of the malaria program. He has extensive international experience in public health, with particular focus on Africa, has worked for the World Health Organization in a senior position in Geneva, has been extensively involved in the UN Millennium Project, serving as one of the coordinators of Task Force 5. That's the one which is interested in dealing with HIV, AIDS, malaria, TB, and access to medicines. We're talking this morning about malaria and efforts to control it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here, and we'll start out with someone in Urbana, and that's line one. Hello.
Hello there. Good morning.
Yes.
Yes, I was just wanting to ask a question about nutrition. Our daughter is a managing supervisor for a non-governmental organization called Project Healthy Children, and she's in Rwanda, in Kigali, Rwanda, right now. They're doing surveys. Their project or mission is to fortify the native foods there so that the children particularly will have a better nutritional level and just be generally healthier. And I wondered if that mission would help with the disease of malaria, although I don't know that it's predominant there. Thanks.
Thank you very much. In fact, Rwanda, in Rwanda, malaria is widespread throughout the country. It's a very serious problem. And the country, the Minister of Health, is doing a very good job in controlling it. Indeed, nutrition is very important in malaria because children who are malnourished are easily susceptible to the malaria infection. So there is a big difference between a well-nourished child and a non-nourished child in terms of malaria infection and transmission.
The caller, did that get it? Your question? Okay, good.
Thank you.
Very good. Next, we'll go to Champaign County, I believe, here, and the caller's on line number two. Hello.
Hi. This virulent malaria, I understand it's in Iraq. They're calling it Blackwater Fever, and I'm wondering what that indicates. Is this like the complete breakdown of public health, and what are the considerations for it being a vector that is any of the malaria that's showing up here on the East Coast or wherever you said in the cities, is it related to this is that a possible vector?
I think the indications you just mentioned in Iraq is due to the parasite. It is caused by Plasmodium falciparum. Plasmodium falciparum attacks vital organs, attacks the kidneys, the liver, and also it destroys a substantial volume of our red blood cells. That's why you would see these indications of black color, because when the red blood cells are hemolyzed, you would have the pigment, and then in urine you will see these black dots or this black as part of the urine. And it is called, when you see conditions like that, it is part of what you call severe or complicated malaria. It means whoever has the infection is not treated in time and allowed for the parasites to multiply without any control. And therefore, it reaches a proportion where vital organs like the kidney, liver, and brain will be damaged and will end up in death. It's a very, very dangerous situation for plasma burning falciparum. At the same time, if an individual who is infected with plasma burning falciparum, if treated in time, the infection will be arrested and the situation will not progress to severe malaria or to death. That's where the irony is. It is a disease that could be easily treated. It is a disease that could be easily prevented. And yet, if we don't get the necessary help, the necessary treatment, and then the disease becomes very dangerous.
I don't want to extend this hot zone argument much further, but is it possible that that kind of situation could be an incubator for other varieties and other maybe less treatable forms, or that's generally a response to treatment, I guess?
Yeah, it cannot be. Fortunately, it cannot be. It cannot be incubated for other pathogens or for other complications. So it is amenable to treatment, but the recommendation is that any case of malaria should seek treatment immediately before it progresses to that situation you just mentioned.
It has the same route with mosquitoes, et cetera, or not? And I'm wondering also, do you see this focus on DDT-treated, this is a very specific question, I guess, this focus on DDT-treated nets as I would say, I would hope that it would be sort of a stopgap measure that would, you know, that would evolve towards, you know, just a general better quality of construction and that sort of thing, rather than seeing that as an end point, if you would. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Yeah, I think what we are talking about here is of two things that come together in order to develop that progression of the disease. It is a parasite, and it is a mosquito. So it is the mosquito that is responsible for the transmission of this pathogen, of this strain of plasma burning falciparum that causes the severe malaria. As to the bennets are not treated with DDT. Bennets are treated only with pyrethroids. Pyrethroids are non-toxic, they are safe, and in fact they were being used in Vietnam and by the U.S. Army. So pyrethroids are used for the treatment of mosquito nets, and they are very, very protective. One is they have a repellent action, and the second is they have a mass action. If, for example, 70% of the population in a community have bennets, the other 30% also will be protected simply by the mass action of the insecticide-treated mosquito nets. Very, very powerful tool. Very intensive studies, community-based studies were conducted by WHO, and it is possible to reduce childhood mortality by 20% just by using bennets alone.
Hmm. I just want to make sure that people know what we're talking about here, because in the prevention of malaria, the attempt to control malaria, there's two major kind of strategies. One would be to try to prevent mosquitoes from biting people in the first place. And then once people became infected with the malaria parasite, then using medications that kill the parasites. I think that some people would argue that one of the most cost-effective, least expensive things that you could do is the thing that you've been talking about a little bit, and that is to give people, or perhaps sell them at very small cost, literally a net that they would put over their bed at night so that when they were sleeping, the mosquitoes couldn't get at them to bite them. And it acts in two ways. First, just simply as a barrier, because it's a light mesh net, but also because it's impregnated with this insecticide. And this is a strategy that a lot of people have advocated. I know that you have and has been used in Ethiopia and other places. These things are relatively speaking, at least it would seem to us, very inexpensive. What are we talking about in terms of cost?
Yeah, we are talking about one bed net, insecticide-treated bed net, along with its distribution costs, like $7. And that individual net has a lifespan about 5 years. It means it will be very effective to kill mosquitoes for 5 years. So we are talking about $1 per capita per year, which is very, very inexpensive.
Mm-hmm. So how, if you were just going to do that, if you were going to try to distribute enough bed nets to people who needed them, let us say, and I know you're, again, you're advocating, other people have said, what we really ought to do is just put together the amount of money, because it's not a lot of money, and just buy them and just hand them out. Is there some way of estimating what that might cost?
Yes, I think globally it would cost around about $1 billion to cover all the malaria areas in Africa.
$1 billion. So, relatively speaking, that's not a that is a lot of money, and yet $1 billion is really, particularly when you look at the positive effects. If you could achieve a high level of control of malaria, $1 billion is really not a whole lot of money.
No, not at all. And this $1 billion I'm talking is about over a 5 years period.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very amount of money, but the benefit in terms of reduction of the disease burden, the benefit in economic return is very substantial.
Now, I guess that there maybe is some argument about the best way to distribute the bed nets. Some people say that the problem with just handing them out is that there's the infrastructure to do that is lacking, and they say that maybe it might actually be more effective to sell them, to use the existing sort of market structure and market system, sell them for very small costs, but sell them. And this is something where I think you've definitely weighed in on the side that says, no, it really makes more sense. What we really ought to be doing, what we can do, is to just give them away.
Well, I think I remember the first meeting of the heads of states in Africa was in 2000 in Abuja, Nigeria. And at that time, they had a commitment to cover 60% of pregnant women and 60% of children with bed nets by 2005. They gave them some 5 years to reach a coverage of 60%.
Mm-hmm.
Up to last year, the coverage was at best 2%, 3%, 5%. Using the modalities you just mentioned, using the modalities that you have to sell them, and therefore there is a private sector, people, you know, if you can distribute Coca-Cola all the way, why not bed nets? All these arguments were presented. But the fact is, the people are too poor to buy even that small amount of money. There is very competitive demands on them. Do they have to to buy exercise books for the child, or do they have to give food to the child, or do they have to buy mosquito nets? So it is really very difficult. And the data clearly shows after 5 years, the coverage was definitely less than 10%. Then when it was realized this is not the way we should go, starting last year, it is possible to do mass distribution. I give you an example of Ethiopia. Ethiopia is one of those underdeveloped countries. The infrastructure is not that great, but they were able to distribute 18 million bed nets in 2 years' time. And you can do that involving the health services, involving the NGOs, all other modalities, the churches, and all these. You can do that, so it is feasible, really, to distribute efficiently mosquito nets, even if you don't have to sell them.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very cost-effective. For example, now in countries like Rwanda, the gentleman mentioned, Ethiopia, the coverage is such, already the burden of disease is coming down. Because what we are doing now is, in addition to the band-aids, because prevention is the most important one, in addition to the prevention, it is not 100% proof. Some people are going to be infected. And then if there is an efficient, effective drug to deal with, like what we have now, and also if you have what you call community-based intervention, you don't have to depend on the health facilities alone. The trick that is now making a very good headway is communities are organized, there will be community-based programs so that the distribution of the mosquitonics are done at community level, drugs are available at the community level. So when a child is sick, there is an immediate response to help that child.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Awash Teklahaimanat. He is professor of clinical epidemiology at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. He is also director of the malaria program there. He has extensive international experience in public health with particular focus on Africa. And we're talking this morning about malaria. Over 40% of the world's population is at risk from malaria. Between 300 and 500 cases occur each year. Over a million people die. 90% of those are in sub-Saharan Africa, and most of them are children under five. But as our guest has said, there is good reason to believe that for a relatively small amount of money, a fairly high level of control can be achieved. Some people do look forward, if not to a day when malaria would be eradicated, one might get to the point where you'd have maybe as much as a 90% reduction in the amount of malaria around the world. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Someone is calling here from Fisher, Round Fisher. This is line number one.
Good morning,
yes.
Professor. My father was also a professor of microbiology and probably did some epidemiology during World War II. My question is, you talk about pyrethroid impregnated mosquito nets. Is that natural pyrethrins, dual-center dries, single-center dries, natural pyrethrins, some of the newer generation synthetic pyrethroids? And based on my experience, I know that natural pyrethrins has got a relatively short shelf life. So I was just wondering what is used there and how long they last. And then the next question is we know that the mosquito is a vector. What's considered the reservoir, and how do you deal with that? And I'll just get off the line.
All right.
Well, very good question. I think initially it started with natural pyrethroids, but now they are using this new generation of synthetic pyrethroids. The technology is improved now. For example, there are the insecticides are impregnated as part of the fiber. It is not like they are dipped when the operation started a few years ago. So there is a very good technology where the insecticides are really impregnated with the fiber. And once in a year, you take out the fibers, like the oleset nets the Japanese are preparing, put it on the sunshine, and then the insecticides will ooze out from the fiber. And thus, the continuity of its residual effect will still be there to kill the mosquitoes.
And
what was the next question?
The other question that the caller asked was, what's the reservoir for the parasite? I'm assuming that the reservoir for the parasite is human beings.
Yes, I think the definitive host, in fact, are the vectors, but the reservoir are the gametocytes, really are the human host. Hmm. They are either in adults but mostly in children.
So this is it lives in people. It lives in the mosquito that transmit the disease. So are there these Plasmodium parasites? Do you find them in other animals, other mammals, for example?
Yes, of course. In fact, there is chicken malaria. There is bird malaria. There are also other primates. But fortunately for us, we are not infected by them, but we have only 4 human malaria parasites. So the fact that you have reservoirs in chicken, reservoirs in birds, and all this does not mean that we are at risk of getting those parasites.
Very good. Let's talk with another caller, someone who is here, I think, on the campus, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. You guys have spoken a lot about using nets treated with pyrethroids as a way to control mosquitoes, but my understanding is that a longer-term solution, however more expensive, is to eliminate the standing water that the mosquitoes need to reproduce. So I was wondering if there are any programs in effect right now that are working on this problem. And I will go ahead and listen off air. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I think basically we just spoke about nets. We did not spoke about the other interventions. Vector control at a larval stage by controlling breeding sites is also one of the potential strategy for controlling malaria. But it is more effective if the breeding sites are finite. Like, for example, if you are talking about the Ogaden, if we are talking in the Sahel areas, or if we are talking in semi-desert areas like Namibia or like Saudi Arabia, where the breeding sites are finite, it is possible to do a very efficient job by reducing the breeding sites. But in rural Africa, it is very difficult, because what happens is Gambia, the most efficient vector I mentioned, breeds in very small sites. Like, for example, if you have a hoof print of an animal, in that depression, if it rains, then mosquito Gambia would breed in that. It likes fresh water, and therefore it is really impossible to do vector control using larval strategy in rural Africa.
What sort of potential is there for using insecticide in homes?
Yes, that is another strategy also, what is called indoor residual spraying. As you know, DDT was used for many years, including this country, but DDT was abandoned for health reasons, primarily because of the mass of DDT amount that was being used in agriculture. A few years ago, I think in consultation with the UN Environmental Agency, the private sector, it was concluded that the amount of DDT that can be used to spray a house is a very small amount, and since it is not directly used in water sources like in springs and in ponds, it is feasible to use DDT for malaria control. And the advantage it has is it stays effective for up to 6 to 9 months. And therefore, it is one of the strategies that are now being advocated by the World Health Organization is as part of the prevention. You can use bed nets treated with insecticides. You can also spray inside of houses with insecticides such as DDT or the pyrethroids, so this is another preventive strategy. The third preventive strategy we did not discuss is intermittent preventive treatment of pregnant women, especially in very intensive transmission areas. Since malaria itself in pregnancy reduces the immunity of the pregnant woman, it's very important that they are treated with malaria, assuming that they are going to get a malaria infection. So 2 times during the period of their pregnancy, they are treated with antimalarial drugs, and that way they are protected. So these are the 3 protections we have. Bed nets, indoor residual spraying, and also intermittent preventive treatment of pregnant women. And the fourth one that we don't have, but many scientists are working on it, is development of vaccines.
This would, of course, be a great advance. And as you say, there is work going on. And I think that while at the same time that people are hopeful that at some point there will be a vaccine, I don't really think anybody thinks this is going to happen anytime soon. Is there some thought that in our lifetime, perhaps, you know, in the next 20, 30, 40 years, we might actually see a vaccine for malaria?
I think there is positive development that is coming, you know. There are some products now that are being studied in the field. One of them, called the RTSS, will go into phase 3 trials soon. So I think in the next, I wouldn't say 30 years, I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we are going to see one or two efficient vaccines that we could add to the armament.
For a long time, I think one of the standard treatments for people who already had gotten malaria, or as a prophylaxis, as a preventive, if people are going to be in areas where malaria was endemic, was a drug called chloroquine. And it worked well, and it was inexpensive. But apparently now we have started to see resistance of the most problematic parasite variety, the Plasmodium falciparum, to chloroquine. Is that the case?
Yes, that is true. Unfortunately, you see, there is no money to be gained from development of drugs for malaria. Hmm. The development of a drug, basically, until it is marketed, would cost around $100 million. And since there is very little return for the industry, the number of drug studies are very, very much limited. So we have very few drugs now that are working. Chloroquine, for example, is no more effective because of resistance development. Fansiran, another drug, sulfadoxin, prometamine, is not also working because of drug resistance. So we are limited to the number of and type of antimalarial drugs we have.
So it sounds as if it's still the case where if you're interested in prevention, that probably the other things that we've talked about, bed nets to try to prevent people from being bitten at night, using insecticides where you can out in the environment and perhaps also in people's homes to try to kill mosquitoes again so that people won't be bitten, those things are much more cost-effective and, in fact, much more doable in the places that we're talking about than handing out anti-malarial drugs to everybody?
I think, you know, the first order of fight against malaria is prevention. I agree with you. That's a good point. Mm-hmm. However, I don't want to leave you with the impression that we don't have an effective drug, even though the type of drugs we have are few because of resistance problems. We have now a drug which is a Chinese product called the artemisinin-based combination in therapy, which is very, very effective, So basically, if people are sick, with 3 days treatment of this artemisinin-based combination therapy, there is 100% probability of success of treatment. So I don't want to leave you with the impression, because yes, we have drug resistance to Fansidara and to chloroquine, but we have an effective drug. And there are other two, three types also that are on the pipeline, you know, to help us with treatment.
And for the anti-malarial drugs that are available now, are these expensive? Is cost a problem?
When you compare with other diseases, for example, TB, HIV, AIDS, the cost is very, very small. But again, because of the poverty issue, for example, a treatment of ACT for an adult will cost like $1.50. And a person, a child who is going to be treated three episodes, four episodes, or five episodes per year, it becomes very expensive for the family to afford those drugs.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I'd just like to introduce again our guest, Dr. Awash Teklehaimanot. He's professor of clinical epidemiology at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, where he's also director of the malaria program. He has a lot of experience in public health with particular focus on Africa. We're talking about malaria. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Just, I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about one aspect of control of the disease, why it is important, and that is not just in sort of general terms that we'd like people to be healthy, but there are real connections between malaria and whether people are healthy or not, and the potential for economic growth in the countries where we're talking about this being a problem, which are already countries where poverty is a problem. Obviously, if people are sick, they're not able to work, they're not able to go out in the field, they're not able to do whatever work they have. And so that to the extent that you can reduce malaria, you can also reduce poverty.
That is true. That is true. In fact, there is a lot of studies conducted by many people, including that of Jeffrey Sachs. And according to his publication, a malarious area would lose about 1% of its GDP as a result of malaria as compared to non-malarious area. So the loss of economic development is significant. When you also consider the rural areas, the farmers, malaria happens to be at its peak during the planting and harvesting season. So if the farmers miss their planting season or harvesting season for malaria, that will be an economic disaster for the whole community. So there is, and also in terms of cognitive development of children, a lot of absentees as a result of being infected and affected by malaria. So there is a very good relationship between social development, economic development, and also malaria. To the extent that malaria is tied up as malaria is associated with poverty. It is a vicious cycle. If you are very poor, you cannot afford the medicine, you cannot afford the preventive measures, and therefore you will be victimized. If you are victimized and therefore you cannot support yourself. And also there is an opportunity cost. There are other areas, very fertile areas, that are avoided for exploitation in agriculture and others simply because they are too deadly, they are too malarious. And therefore people will be forced to live and farm in marginal areas. Had malaria been controlled in those sites, then the people would move into those fertile areas. They will be very productive, and therefore their economics will improve. Mm-hmm. But I think it is also very important now, unlike, you see, the eradication was tried in 1950s, 60s. It did not work out in most countries. So there was kind of a fatalistic approach, there is nothing we could do on malaria. But now with the strategies we have, with the tools we have, there is a renewed momentum now. The international community, if you consider the President's Malaria Initiative, if you consider the Global Fund, the World Bank's Booster Program and others, there is now a concerted effort to mobilize resources in the order of $3 to $4 billion per year for the next few years, in order to cut down the burden of malaria to the minimum, and even in some areas to move towards prospects for elimination and eradication. The Gates Foundation, for example, is committed to malaria eradication and elimination. So the timing is very good now for a worldwide concerted effort on malaria control.
We have a couple of minutes left and two callers, and we'll try to get them both in here. We'll go first to someone in Terre Haute, Indiana, I believe, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for the program. I'm very interested in this because I'll just make one comment. When I was a child of seven, I had malaria and just about died from it because of the high fevers and so forth. And I got it in Terre Haute, Indiana. And that was kind of the problem, was that nobody could diagnose me. And they treated me for many, many different things. But it took a doctor who had been in the Army in the South Pacific and had contracted malaria to come around and find what it was, because he knew the symptoms. So I don't know if in the remote areas, and I say remote because they're not normally served by people who are familiar with it, if they have trouble getting treatment to take care of the situation. I went for probably 3 to 4 months in getting a diagnosis and any treatment at all, and there's very few drugs. Quinine was not available, and so they tried a number of drugs, and Adderbrin was used, but it was in very short supply.
Well, we did. It's interesting the caller should tell this story, Dr. Tekla Hamna, because certainly we did talk a little bit earlier in the program about the fact that, there has been historically and still is today malaria in the United States. So it is possible to get it here in the United States. While it's not common, fortunately, it still exists. It is, and I'm sure that you would say, yes, it is true that in many parts of the world that that people don't have access to health care. And although I suppose in places where malaria is endemic, that when people see it, they know what it is.
It is true. I think the gentleman was very lucky to make it, because until the last 10, 20 years, the disease was not recognized easily here. In fact, we have to send blood samples to CDC and all this. Now the situation has improved, I think, globally. But it is true. In developing countries, in the remote areas, they know what it is, but they don't have the means to treat it. So it is all the same.
We'll try to get one more caller here. I thank the last caller. This is someone here on line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mine sort of meshes with the last one. My father had it. He came home with from a CB in the Navy when I was a little girl, and he would have attacks for years afterwards. And you could, when he had an attack, it would be so bad that you could feel the house shaking when he had these chills, and he was upstairs in his bed, and it would happen, and he wouldn't know they were coming on, and sometimes we would be somewhere, and he'd have an attack, and we'd have to get somebody to drive us home. It was a terrible disease, and he took quinine and Adderbrin and things like that, but he finally, there was a doctor that had been in the Navy during the war, and he cured my father, but he'd gone to Naval Bethesda Hospital and all kinds of places, and they couldn't cure the kind of malaria he had. And I was told by my mom that there were different, I don't know what you call it, species of brain, that all malaria wasn't the same.
Yes, it was vivax malaria, I think, because that is the one who has relapses. It was vivax malaria. And it cannot be easily treated because the parasites, they sleep in the liver. They call them hypnozites. They sleep in the liver, and then when conditions, when the, for example, when your dad is stressed or weak for certain reasons, after 6 months or a year, they would manifest and then give him the problem. So this is vivax malaria.
Oh, well, it was really scary as a child to hear your father when he said, you know, just shaking. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's
amount of shaking. Not like anything I'd ever seen before. I'll hang up. Thank you very much for the program. It was wonderful.
Oh, that indeed points out the fact that there, in some of these varieties of malaria, that it's something that can affect the person for many, many years, not kill them, but periodically certainly make them sick enough so that they couldn't have a normal life.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
Do you think, you know, we talked about the fact that the ambitious goals for fighting malaria have been set out, and in fact that one of the Millennium Development Goals adopted by the UN back in 2000 is to significantly reduce the incidence, the spread and incidence of diseases, not just malaria, but also diseases like HIV, AIDS. And some people have talked about and set the goal of 2015 to do this. Some people have talked about the possibility of as much as a 75% eradication by that point. Do you think that's an achievable goal?
Yes, I think it is achievable now. You know, I was involved when the Abuja targets were set, and I also is involved in the in this MDG development, and I see what the momentum is, and in fact, in some countries we may even achieve by 2015, in small islands, in small countries, we may even achieve eradication of malaria or elimination of malaria.
Well, I think at that we're going to have to finish up again with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Awash Teklehaimanot from Columbia University. He's professor of clinical epidemiology there and also director of the malaria program. Dr. Teklehaimanot, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.